We have a guest today, Curtis Greco. He wrote the book, well, the book series of books. It's Blind Vision Books, and he's the founder of the Imperfect Messenger Foundation. Curtis, welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning. Tim, how are you? I guess it's afternoon where you're at.
Yes, we are approaching 12:30. It's a great afternoon today.
Excellent.
You know what's great is I get to talk to patriots all over the country, and I get to have people like you on my show.
Well, you know, it's an extraordinary opportunity, not only for me, but moreover for the audience, to begin to explore areas that have largely been ignored for quite some time. And it's like, it's really the glory of it is to find ourselves, you, me, and others like us, and as well your audience, at a time in American history where years from now people will look back and say there were people who are willing to stand up and reinvigorate a cause worth defending. And I you know, to whatever extent I do it, I just think it's an extraordinary opportunity. It's a great time to be alive in America.
Well, and I agree. I actually read my speech. If I was ever on the House and Senate floor, I read my list of objections about the people we have that are just messing. It's their own personal playground there in Washington. I guess that's what irritates me the most, is they're not doing their stewardship or their sacred duty to the American people. It's a personal playground, and they're not, you know, and it's funny, your book says America needs jobs, you realize that, but Washington's never going to create these.
Right.
And first, before we go into that, this is Blind Vision is a series of three books, correct?
Correct.
Go ahead and give us a brief little thing. It's three books. It starts with...
First book in the series is called We Hold These Truths. Book two is called Value Given, Value Received. And book three is called Valor and Prosperity. The three books, in a short brief of it, is a commentary that is a direct challenge to the belief system of the day that would have you believe that the United States concept of government, this idea we call representative form of government, is a living progressive interpretation that is subject to the impulse of the contemporary or current sentiments, when in fact it's nothing like that. It is, and so what I do is I take a look at it from a completely different perspective. I take a look at it, and We Hold These Truths. It says, the title speaks of what the first volume is about. We talk about the historical significance and relevance today of these things we say we hold to be true. And then we go into Value Given, Value Received, which is a brief and very simplistic economic, conceptual economic discussion about what is capitalism, how did we get to where we had, and what were the kinetic forces that gave us great economic success in the country, and then what happened to it. And then we move into book three, Valor and Prosperity, which is simply this. It is the complete antithesis of stimulus packages. I create a series of stimulus concepts that say if we really want to reinvigorate the United States, instead of giving money away, instead of this impulse notion of governance that we seem to have saturated the country and literally destroyed the native intuitiveness of personal perfection, that is, you know, independent individuals, people who are self-reliant. And if we were really truly interested in doing this, in standing up and standing for a cause worth perfecting, how would we do it? What are some ideas? And that's what Valor and Prosperity talks about.
And, you know, those are great. We're going to get a little bit more in depth on that. Now, what is the Imperfect Messenger Foundation?
The Imperfect Messenger Foundation is an entity I've, you know, put together to house some of the works that I do personally is in these areas. And, you know, the website's out there, the imperfectmessenger.com, and, you know, the blog, Facebook, and all that sort of stuff, audio, video, radio files, all these different things that I do. But it was really, I needed to try to expand it to not be about Curtis and what Curtis does and my creative abilities and so on. And it really, I wanted to be able to begin to compel people to say, and have a place where if they were compelled, they could express these ideas. And it means this. One of the founding ideals of the Perfect Messenger Foundation is in the mission statement, and it says this. It says, when the message is true, it remains so, despite the imperfections of the messenger. In other words, we all come to the planet, we all come to this terrain, this domain of life, whatever your origins of thought might be, whether it's divine or coincidental, whatever, it's still a matter of fact as you are here and you are occupying space. And if you're going to be a part of a life-changing experience, you need to express it. You need to do something to make a difference and not just talk about it. So everybody's got moments of brilliance, moments of genius. And even though we do come to the space that humans have this sort of uncanny way of screwing things up, you know. and I've done some
Yeah,
really,
just watch C-SPAN.
Yeah, I mean, I've done some really stupid things over my 51 years, but I remember a quote taken from Ted Kennedy Jr., who spoke at his father's eulogy, and he said, one of the most important things I learned from my father, the now late senator, he says, he taught me that even our most profound failures are ultimately survivable. Now, like Ted Kennedy or not, if that is really something that Ted Kennedy taught his son, that is a lesson we can all learn from.
And I agree with you. Hey, Curtis, we've got to take a break, so just hold on. We'll be back with more Curtis Greco after this break. Now, what we were saying before the break, and it's amazing, you're going to have people that have exposure, like you were saying, I think it was a Kennedy, that are going to say great words of wisdom that everybody can learn from. And whether you like the person or not, if you take bits and pieces of everybody, you can compile a perfect person, you know?
Absolutely. Here's one of the things that, you know, I to clean up that and tie the knots around that, or the loop around that comment, was just to resolve the issue of the Imperfect Messenger Foundation. And really what I'm just trying to do is I'm trying to take a concept that starts with something like this. The Declaration of Independence is a divinely inspired document that is largely ignored by most Americans. Most Americans pay no attention to the significance of what that document means. And I believe that because of that lack of patience and that lack of dedication to the ideals of the country and the significance that gave this country life, we have allowed the degradation wholesale on a national level of a country and an ideal. And whether you're a senator or a congressman, or whether the son of a senator or a congressman, or a real estate broker like me, or with a guy who spent, you know, has 20 years in high finance and regulatory work back when I was practicing in public accounting and writing briefs for the Senate Finance Committee and doing all sorts of crazy things, or to a guy or a gal who's just literally looking to fulfill their life's calling by being a perfectly capable father and a perfectly capable mother. Whatever person, whatever the individual's life story is or life history is, we all need to understand that there is something perfect about the idea that is the United States. There is something perfect. Andrew Jackson had a great comment. He said, you know, Americans are not a perfect people. However, we are called to a perfect mission. And so if we take that idea and we look at the world around us, what has become the United States. In my recent article, in a recent article of mine that is on the website, it also appears on the website, on the Foundation's website, it's called Refusing Success. And I make a point in there, and I welcome your audience and today or whenever you have the chance to visit the website and read the article. But in there is an interesting observation that I pull to try to draw the public's interest in, and it goes like this. Most folks need to remember that 46% of the senators and congressmen that occupy elected offices are attorneys. Now, I don't really have a problem with attorneys at all. In fact, I have one of the most significant men I've ever met in my life is my older brother, and he's an attorney, and he's, you know, works in a specific segment of the profession. He's an extraordinary man. So there is nothing about the profession necessarily, but what's important to remember about the profession is this. The practice of law is not the practice of justice. It is the practice of the law. And the practice of the law does not encourage the process of excelling to a higher ideal. In fact, what the practice of law does is it negotiates and arbitrates down to the lowest possible common denominator to create agreement. You know, you hear it all the time. We've come to a bipartisan accord, right? Well, you're going to have to argue with me pretty strenuously to say to me that a bipartisan accord always becomes the highest expression of governance. We all know better than that. We've got a legacy of legislative destruction that will prove the point that I intend to make, and that is this. You cannot have the high ideal of republicanism as a form of government when the approach to perfecting it is an expression of lowest common denominator. That is why we have a sentiment of apathy in governance. That is a reason why you have idiotic laws passed, whether it be START treaties or extension of benefits under this tax deal, or DREAM Acts and Obamacare Acts and all this sort of stuff. Nobody seems to ever ask the question, and I don't know, you know, if you ever see this, and judging from your personal history, I'm sure it keys your curiosity just as well as mine, but why doesn't anybody in the Senate and the House ever ask themselves, why are we doing this?
That was my opening today. Nobody questions anything. They just get in there and they play this game in their own personal playground.
Yeah.
We're the ones who pay the price, and nobody ever asked that question. Why are we doing such a stupid thing? Why are we even looking at this?
Yeah, why is the rush to failure so completely captivating to these people that they literally toss out conscientious objections or intellectually sound discourse in favor of legislating failure? The rush to impulsive response, I just don't understand it. I can't explain it, okay? I can't explain it. Why is there such a rush to do this?
You know, and it's like you said, I have no explanation for it either, but looking at the people, I understand why, you know, I understand why it's going on, but I can't explain it. It's
right.
Like these people aren't attached to the same reality you and me are.
No, they don't. You know, you look at this, you know, you listen to Nancy Pelosi, San Fran Nan. I mean, I'm sure she's a great lady. I'm sure her grandchildren look at her with admiration and delight because it's grandma. Right? I'm sure her children probably walk down the street and say, well, I think I'll just think of her as mom, because if I think of her as the
Speaker of the House.
I'm embarrassed. I mean, I don't really know, and I shouldn't say that way, because, you know, I don't know these things. But what I do know is this. Whenever I hear Nancy Pelosi say that we need to pass $50 billion in extending unemployment benefits, and she says that it's going to stimulate the economy, I got to ask a question, and maybe you can help me figure this one out, and your audience may think on it as well. If we think that this, we know that no more than at any given time, 18 cents of every dollar makes it back to the coffers of the federal government in the form of tax revenues. So, and 8 cents of that tends to get out there into the states. So the federal government at best is going to get 10 cents of every dollar in tax and revenues back. So I have to ask a question, okay? If you're going to give out $50 billion and only 10% of it's ever going to come back in the form of tax revenue, where's the $40 billion in the debt that you've accumulated that remains going to get paid off?
It's not. That's why we got $14 trillion in debt.
Yeah. I mean, well, that's the $14 trillion you and I have been told is there, when in fact it's actually significantly more than that.
Yeah, 57 to 60-something trillion.
Right. So these are the kind of questions, and we go back to that idea that I asked, you know, we were talking about this rush to impulsive legislation. You know, where's the guy or the gal who's back in office, who's a senator or congressman, where's the guy or the gal who's going to sit there and say, hey, wait a second, something's that's not right here. Why are we doing this? And so the book series came out about as a result of some work that I was doing, a couple of speaking engagements I'd done, and I'd done some luncheons at some financial committee type meetings, and, you know, in the profession and banking and mortgages and all this sort of nonsense. And somebody came up to me at one of them and said, hey, you know, Curtis, you know, this is great material. You know, where can I get one of your books? And at that point, I hadn't written a book, you know. And I started to look at the world around me, and I started to see the failures, and I started to see the devastation of the public, you know, the homeowners, and traveling into Memphis, Tennessee, and looking at the vacant buildings, and being in Cleveland, and back in Michigan, and Raleigh, North Carolina, Durham, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, different places around the country. And I saw such utter and complete economic devastation, And I said to myself, you know, I got tired of hearing people say to me, you know, Curtis, somebody's got to do something about this. And I thought to myself, you know, yeah, somebody's got to do something about it. And then I thought to myself, well, you know, you're just one guy, Curtis, you know, what can you do? And I said, well, I can write a book. And the book ended up in 3 books. And, you know, they're selling, and people are giving them away as Christmas gifts, and I'm getting bumping into people at places and airports, and I'm seeing them sitting there, and I look over to see what they're reading, and I'll be darned if it's not one of my books, you know. And I got in an aircraft the other day, a couple weeks ago, I should say, and in the back pocket of the seat pocket in front of me.
Can you hold on for just a second? Keep that thought. We're going to be taking a quick break here. We'll be back on the other side. I'm here. This is Tim, Buyback America Radio, with Curtis Greco. Everybody's talking at me. This is Tim, your host, Buyback America Radio, here with Curtis Greco. He wrote the Blind Vision series, the founder of the Imperfect... Oh, God, I forgot the name right now.
The Imperfect
Messenger Foundation. You were on a flight, and you were telling us a story. You were on a flight. What happened?
Well, this was just an exciting moment. You know, I was flying. I was in a seat, and I looked to pull something out of the pocket in front of me, and I'll be son of a gun if one of my books wasn't in there, with a note on the inside jacket that said, "Everybody needs to read this book." And so it's, you know, this is a self-funded venture on my part that seeks to engage the public in a conversation that needs to be had. There's, if you go to the website, if your audience wants to go to the website, you'll see the 3 books on there. There's a little section tab below each of the books. You can download segments of the books and read them. You know, just give you a little taste of what they are. They're not Harlequin romances. You know, they're not going to be something that's going to put you to sleep with the dreams of, you know, sugar plum fairies. They are, however, well-written dialogues that will introduce you to concepts that you've never thought of.
I was going to say no Harlequin romance, but Washington isn't no love story, let me tell you.
You're absolutely right, my friend. And really what the motivation about this is really to direct the public to an idea that says something along these lines. If you want what you believe is your inalienable right to fully express, or as I say it, a man must be free for independence to be at liberty to be expressed. If you really believe those to be your inalienable rights, and there's about 300 million Americans out there that need to kind of wake up and start functioning in a pattern that holds government accountable to the preservation of your rights, and there are strategic ways to do it, and we can. I mean, that's the beauty of that quote from Ted Kennedy, is that even our most profound failures are ultimately survivable. We can do this. The flaw of the Tea Party movement is, I mean, I'm a fan of the idea of it, but as I mentioned in some of my articles, the problem with the Tea Party concept as it presently is that it exposes the public's interest to the same consequence of the venture that produced Bill Clinton, and I'm speaking specifically of the Ross Perot venture, United We Stand America. Without a crystal clear declaration of what it is that entity stands for, it will always be at risk for being derailed by the political machinery that would cause itself to be either repackaged or reformulated and misdirected to their own divisive ends. You know, the great consequence of republicanism, as Thomas Jefferson said, was that the created would believe itself superior to that which created it. And that's why you have government not functioning the way it is. That's why you have Obama doing the things he does, Harry Reid, John McCain, you name it. The culprits are everywhere. And I don't really give too much – I try to stay away from being polemic as far as calling out the particular foot soldiers of this process, but I – really try to simply say, look, they're going to do what they're going to do, but you know what? There's more of us than there are of them. There's no place to go other than, I mean, there's no new world, right? And so I'm not leaving. How about you?
I'm not going anywhere. There's nowhere else to go if you like what America has to offer. There's nothing like it in the world.
Nowhere else to go, my friend. And so what I say is we need to stand and be accounted. We need to stand and be accountable. And this is why I love the idea of Buy Back America. The idea, you know, and I'll give you an instance of this. You know, one of the promos that we're doing with the foundation is to offer some paraphernalia. You know, I want to offer, you know, we've been wanting to offer some hats and, you know, the typical stuff that, you know, so you can have a recognition, some branding, some placement, right? Do you know, I have not been able to find a company that makes baseball caps in the United States.
I found one.
Well, then you and I are going to have to talk off air because I got to tell you, I am stunned. So what I think, you know, what the beauty of the Buy Back America concept is this, is that it does what Americans have always done, and that is promote an environment where you are free to excel at your own pace and reinstill that virtue back into those which are willing to participate at that level. You know, I don't know that folks really expect the government, the nanny state concept, to really prevail. But in the absence of any form of leadership, you know, the public is going to respond to the pablum that is tossed at them. And so in the absence of a clear agenda and a clear and deliberate set of goals, or, as I mentioned earlier, declaration, the public is left to the divisiveness of the prominent messenger of the time, right? And so if you get enough people in a room and you explain to them that this group is responsible for their lot in life, now you got somebody to blame for your own failures. And I think it's about time we as a people see it for what it is and get back on track to what lies back of the concept of American Republican form of government and get it back into the place it needs to be. And I believe we can do it.
Oh, and I agree with you. We are coming up to our top of the hour break. That's a 6 or 7 if you need to stretch your leg, Curtis.
Okay.
When we get back, we're going to go into some questions for you that actually you have some simple solutions, or maybe not so simple, but you have some ideas on how we can fix some of these issues. I'm going to ask you some questions. We're going to open it up to some callers when we get back. Is that okay with you?
Excellent. I was hoping we would get there because that's what we need to do. We need to tell people that there are solutions and ways to do it. So let's do it.
And okay, and one other thing. I had a caller off air. Julie wants to know where your book's available. Can you say that real quick?
Real quick. Amazon's the quickest way to get them. They're, of course, available at all your local bookstores, et cetera, et cetera. But the quickest way to get them is to go right online, link through the Imperfect Messenger website, and it'll take you right to Amazon.
So there you go, Julie. You can get them off of Amazon. If you go to the Imperfect Messenger website, you can just link straight to the book. And, you know, if it's something you want to read or pass along, I'm sure Curtis will appreciate that. We're going to be taking a break. When we get back, we're going to ask him the questions on how we can fix our situation. So stretch your legs for, you know, the next 6 to 8 minutes. You're not going to want to miss this next hour. We'll be back with more Buy Back America Radio and more of our guest, Curtis Greco, after this.
Tim Alders.
Welcome back, Patriots. Buy Back America Radio, the second hour. We're here with Curtis Greco. Curtis, welcome back.
Thank you, Tim. Good to be with you. Enjoying it. I'm very much, very, very, very much.
We're going to get to the meat of this. And if you want to call in and ask Curtis a question as we're going through these questions, you can call us at 801-254-5855, Utah County 470-5855, Davis and Weber 670-5855. Okay, Curtis, everybody knows one of our key issues in America right now is jobs. We need them. People don't have them. I say there's no manufacturing. We've systematically wiped out our ability to produce. You say if new jobs are coming, they're not going to probably come from Washington. I know why I have a negative view of Washington, but why do you, it seems like you have a negative view of our country leaders.
Absolutely. But, you know, I have to always remind myself that they are Americans. They may not be acting like it. They may not understand it, but they are still, they still are my countrymen. But one of the beauties of, there's a great quote from Alexander de Tocqueville, and it's a quote that I think is a great lead into the topics we're going to chat about right now. And he says this, He said, the greatness of America lies not in being more enlightened than any other nation, but rather in her ability to repair her faults. A powerful statement about the native genius of a concept of self-reliance that is embodied by the Declaration of Independence, observed by man in the 1800s, who clearly observed, the late 1800s, who clearly observed the strengths of the United States and its people. Now, you're right. The problem with the federal government that most people fail to realize is that at the heart of our failures economically are two critical points. And number one is the fact that what government has to give, it acquires by taking. People don't realize that all of these gifts of entitlement programs, of stimulus packages, all resolve to one fundamental truth, and that is the money that comes or is dispersed through the government occurs from taking it from the taxpayer, whether in the form of tax revenues or in the form of burdening the taxpayer with obscene amounts of debt. That's number one. Number two, the belief that government can create jobs through these various misadventures. And again, if you tie those two thoughts together, this belief that government can do this, one also has to accept the first premise. And the first premise is that anything the government gives, it first acquires by taking. You know, the true problem of a concept that deals with this idea of totalitarian regimes is not so much that they exist, but more so because of their effect on what becomes of choice. You know, a economic failure of concepts of, you know, that have given rise to this concept of the new American concept of capitalism, which is really in effect controlled markets, is really not because these entities or businesses or government believes in freedom. In fact, what it does is it fears free market forces. And because of that, it articulates its rather profound strengths of legislative ability unchecked by conscience to maneuver these and interfere with fundamental economic principles, which I call native economy. And to understand it, we have to first realize that what is required to create jobs is so completely and diametrically opposed to what the function of government is, which is simply to preserve your rights, your inalienable rights, in such a way as to prevent interference from your exercising them. That's it. That is the sum total of the function expressed by the Declaration of Independence. How do we do this? Jobs, how they actually created? Understand a fundamental economic principle that I teach and that I write about, and it's called the native economy. There's a fundamental truth about how economy functions and how it becomes prolific and how it becomes self-sustaining, and it deals with this idea of native economy. Native economy in its simplest forms is demand in search of supply. That's all there is to economics. Think about what that means. It's a very simple phrase, and it goes like this. When you have a desire to fill a need which you have, whether it's to feed your family or provide shelter for your family or find transportation, there is someone out there in the environment who has the ability to generate a supply to meet your demand. And that creates the fundamentals of an economic cycle. That is not possible for it to occur in a government-controlled environment. Simply not possible. Because the moment government enters into the equation, they do stupid things like this. Allow collective bargaining of unions. Not that unions don't have a function. I'm not going to get into that argument because I really don't think that they do, but I know there are some people that believe they do. But the fact of the matter is they do not add value to the economic cycle. They actually extract value from the economic cycle. Number two, they create idiotic notions such as government tax credits to corporations and called investment tax credits. Now, you might see or a person out there in your audience might say, but you know, Curtis, it's important that we stimulate the economic cycle. Well, is it? If you're going to take taxpayer dollars and give it in the form of a tax credit to an economic venture, let's say General Motors, to stimulate the economic cycle of General Motors, whether it be in direct tax credits or equally dubious expressions of misdirection, such as what was it last summer, the clunker, cash for clunkers program, right? Think about this. If the company or economic entity is not economically viable, is throwing more money after a bad venture going to turn something bad into something good, or does it simply make a bad thing worse? I will, of course, argue on the latter, that in fact it actually makes a bad thing worse.
I'll agree with you on that.
It's simply not possible. It doesn't work that way. But yet, what we've done in the U.S. economy, we had the opportunity at the zenith, at the apogee of our economic success, to invest in perpetuating the economic cycle of success, what I call progenerative economics. No, what we did was we passed tax laws or enjoined the country to treaties that actually encouraged U.S. corporations to take their abundant liquidity and not only invest it offshore, but to actually create such a powerful and overwhelming vacuum in the process that the economic productivity of the nation actually went with it. Think about this. Today, if the U.S. wanted to build a new space shuttle, do you know we can't do it? Do you know we we do not have the technological resources and manufacturing capability to actually do it. And so what we need to do is put back into the equation a fundamental mechanism that creates an environment where not only are we redirecting investment into the United States, but we make the failure of corporations to do so economically prohibitive. So, for example, and again, I don't want to. I can dive into some real quick ones if you want, but I want to pause for a second because I just went into this long tirade, and I bet I didn't pause long enough for you to comment.
But you know, it's okay. It's like me. I get so passionate about everything that's going wrong in our country, and I don't understand how so many people out there are so complacent. So when I hear somebody as passionate as me, sometimes it's fun to just sit back and listen because it's not brain surgery to repair a lot of the issues that's going on in our country.
And
our politicians are just ignoring it.
Well, going back to my comment about, you know, the practice of law, remember, they aren't the system of government as it presently is practiced revolves around impulse legislation, and that is the appearance of creating a need so that it appears that they're fulfilling a need. But it's important to understand that this presumed need is a complete fabrication.
We want to know what you're feeling here at K-Talk. You got Tim, the host of Buyback America Radio, here with Curtis Greco. Curtis, we're just like rambling on today.
Yes. Well, but you know, you made a great comment before the break. It's about passion. It's seeing a need, it's seeing a value, and seeing it squandered. And you want to, if you're a thinking, passionate, devout individual, you look at it and say, wait a second, we can't let this happen. And so you want to natively, intuitively, you understand that you don't kick people off the life raft, you build a bigger boat, right? You create a legion of followers like the signatures of the Declaration of Independence. All individual men of distinct and individual ambitions. However, what they did so precisely and so successfully is they rallied around a common ideal, and we can do the same thing. And I believe it, and I believe that's a cause to be passionate and hopeful about the future. Before the break, we talked about, you know, some job creation strategies, and if you want,
yeah.
I'll jump into a quick couple of them, and this way you'll have some. Maybe some body of content for your listeners who might want to call in.
Okay, but let me ask a two-part question, and I'm going to give you my concept of it, and then I'll let you go.
Got it.
Now, if the jobs aren't going to come from Washington, which I think me and you both agree from where they're going to come from, they're going to have to come from us, is my opinion on this. And if our country's going to create new jobs, doesn't it have to start in Washington? I almost think a little bit it does. We need to stop this inflow and this dumping that we have from India and China of these products so that people who have a concept that's, you know, a quality product that they want to manufacture here in America can actually do it. So now you go ahead and throw your things out there. And then if callers want to call in, it's 254-5855.
You're absolutely right. You know, if government needs to do government job, okay? And if government does its job, it would do something along this line. Some of these are directly from the Blind Vision series. Number one, incentivize the tax code for job creation and domestic investment. Number two, union reform. Eliminate the collective bargaining mandate. Three, target and incentivize domestic enterprise. Number four, create trade policy that benefits the U.S. Number five, legal reform. We need to get back to judicial review, malpractice, and prosecutorial misconduct. The next one, cut or restructure government administrative overburden. And the last one for now, target sustainable energy development. Now, there's a couple of quick sidebars to each of these, but I just want to hit two of them. When we talk about create trade policy that benefits the U.S., what the government will tell you is that that's protectionism, right? Well, here I got a good response for your listenership. When you hear a congressman or a senator use the word protectionism, automatically understand they do not understand or grasp the fundamentals of an economic cycle. Two, if a senator or a congressman is not going to engage themselves in the processes necessary to protect and preserve your inalienable rights, you have no use for them. Protectionism? Absolutely. That's exactly what Congress, that's exactly what the Declaration of Independence, that's exactly what the Constitution of the United States requires. That's why they say, uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Okay? So when we get into that, then that moves into this concept of why I bring up the issue of target sustainable energy development. One of the critical issues that we as a country are going to have to face as we move forward into the regeneration of the country is to remember a critical point, and that is this. One of the great components of the U.S.'s economic success was the fact that we had abundant and inexpensive energy. It could afford to fuel the explosive economic processes that took place in this country in the late 1800s and through the mid 1950s, 1960s. The moment we saw the fouling of the affordability factor of oil through in the 70s and the OPEC conundrum that took place is the moment we saw the vulnerability of divisiveness that can occur when you allow a totalitarian approach to controlling a segment of the economy, in this case, energy. I think one of the great things that this country can do that will have a multiplying economic benefit is to refine a provable, sustainable, and progenerative energy source. To do that, and I'm not talking about wind farms or solar panels or, you know, any of this sort of fad type transitory impulse approach to energy, but I do say that it is a solution, whether it's in refining and compacting nuclear fusion to a functional level where you regionalize energy power grids, to or we go to what I think offers the most promising, more immediate energy point, and that is hydrogen, hydrogen fuel cells. We're being told it's a dangerous thing, it's an expensive thing, it's all this sort of stuff that will compel people to look at it and say, it's too nebulous, too uncertain. No, I think that's just a form that's being used to champion the waste of federal or taxpayer dollars into ethanol subsidies that right now are being subsidized at approximately $1.78 of every gallon of ethanol produced is subsidized through U.S. through subsidies of some form through the federal government. That's not free market response to a need.
I agree with you. And, you know, we're being told this by the same people who think TSA pat-downs are good. So.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I had a guy say to me on a radio show, was a call-in, and he said the Constitution of the United States does not guarantee your right to fly. And I told him, I said, you know, I feel bad for you. I feel sorry for you. I said, but you know what I feel even worse about is the fact that there's an audience of people that you certainly have a circle of influence with that actually believe what you tell them. I got bad news for you, Pally. The Constitution is not – you're absolutely right. The Constitution does not define your right to fly. What it does, however, is intended to preserve your inalienable rights to do precisely what it is that you want to do, which, by the way, includes your ability to freely move about your own country.
Well, and I'm curious, where does it define the government's right to frisk us?
Yeah, I mean, that,
that's the best question. Where does it define their rights to molest us in an airport?
No, and this is my point. You know, is that this is the fundamental flaw in the public's understanding of what the Declaration of Independence says and what it means and how it's so vital in understanding the role of government as fully expressed by the Constitution of the United States. Sometime when your audience and you have the time, go to the website, theimperfectmessenger.com. Under the multimedia tab, you'll see an audio clip in there, or a video clip, entitled Founding Ideals in Exile. It's a 7-minute clip. It's extraordinarily provocative in how it explains the beauty of the Declaration of Independence. I invite your audience and any, to go and visit. You can find it not only at the website. If you just simply go into YouTube and type in Curtis Greco, Founding Ideals in Exile, it'll pop up on YouTube as well. So it's a great piece.
I'll probably just get it and play it for a lot of my listeners.
You'll enjoy it. You'll enjoy it. So there's some of these job creation strategies are really address what you mentioned at the outset, and that is it has to start at the government level. You're right, because what's happened is the government has been the culprit in allowing all of this to occur, and so consequently the response to correcting it will have to come from some sort of government function. But we also need to remember this, that the U.S. government is never going to fix itself. It is not the nature of an addict to, you know, unless they've got an overwhelming amount of discipline, self-discipline, to correct or get the error of its ways. This is the beauty of the resurgence that we're starting to hear about the country, of the impact and reinstating the 10th Amendment. In Book 3 of the Blind Vision series, I talk about some of these things in asserting states' rights, and I think that when folks get the time and they explore these books, you're going to find some really interesting dialogue on some specific strategies that we can affect on the state level to do just that. And I think it's a great component of what will ultimately become the next phase in the evolution of a wonderful, an absolutely wonderful country and an extraordinarily passionate population. And that's why, again, I always say, I don't want to focus on the problems. I want to focus on the solutions. And I want to focus on teasing the public with some of these hot-button issues that they can look at. And when they're engaged in dialogue with folks, when they're out amongst their community and they hear somebody say, the government needs to, I need the government to take care of this. Or when they hear a senator or a congressman blurt out something about the success of failure and the passage of some bizarre funding legislation or, Medicaid expansion or Social Security benefits increases, and you can actually have an intellectually sound body of information to be able to toss at these people and say, how does this make sense, Senator? How does this make sense, Congressman? How can you tell your constituency that by stealing from them, you are somehow helping them?
I agree. Hey, Curtis, we're going to take a break here. Call in now. After the break, I'll get your calls on the air, I promise. I've had some callers that couldn't hold. Call back up. We'll get you on the air right after this break with Curtis Greco. A lot of people have their minds set. A lot of people are waking up. I'm here with my guest, Curtis Greco. He is the founder of the Imperfect Messenger Foundation. He is the author of the Blind Vision book series. In your books, on your blog, Curtis, you say that we're going to have to take some brave and creative action. You said get rid of unions. You think that should be optional for all workers. Are you there?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Sorry, I was listening to you.
Can you help us understand? Now, you also said that you think jobs can be created by removing health care, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid from government management.
Absolutely. And why? Because by freeing up the burden of government as in a form of economic extortion, you free up the individual to accomplish two critical things. Number one, to orientate themselves to a need that they uniquely have and finding a source to fill it. instead of becoming an entitlement baby who is baying at the door of the Lord and Master of government, asking them to save them. It's a complete reversal of what the public has come to expect from government. And also, it pushes the envelope of the environment to not only encourage self-development of economic enterprise, but it actually, in the absence of government intervention and interference, it actually becomes a necessity.
And a lot of people think that we could actually do a better job of running these programs than our government can in the first place anyway.
Well, and of course, you know, the other thing, the problem that what happens with government is that government has taken on this sort of concept that believes that it can culture its own sort of ethos. In other words, we can write our own rules, and simply because we state them, it makes them so. And that gives rise to some of these idiotic and somewhat benign, or I should say malignant, economic theories such as Keynesianism or progressive economic ideologies that are promulgated by guys like Krugman, that is a frequent participant writer in New York Times. And he's a great man, and I've enjoyed having dialogues with him. But you know, this is the problem when you take the elitist view of academicians' perspective of how a native process works. How unfortunate, because it takes a person's idea who has never had to meet a payroll, who has never had to start with nothing but the pure genius of inspired mind, and put together the required effort and intellect and resources to create, who has never had to do that, and then put them in the cloistered environment of academia and ask them to give you a theoretical explanation on how to make something which they fundamentally know nothing about work.
They have no practical knowledge in. They have book knowledge.
They have no practical knowledge. I mean, you know, but I'll tell you what, I will give credibility. I think one of the most intelligent businessmen I know is a fella here in the town I live in Santa Rosa, California, which is about an hour north of San Francisco, who runs a window washing business. And he is incredibly financially successful doing it. Now, I'll rely on his advice long before I will listen to an MIT professor.
Amen. I agree with you there.
You know, I want to walk in the pattern, and I believe other people do as well. I want to walk in the pattern, in the footsteps of people who can not only give me leadership because they've been there and done that, but that in the process of providing me leadership also provide me with a roadmap that I can duplicate their success with.
You know, and Donald Trump probably irritated me quite a bit, just his attitude, but recently I've become sort of a fan of Mr. Trump. He has become successful. He recognizes the problem. I had some clips of Trump on my show where he even says the Chinese people are laughing at Americans. We need to tax and tariff them so we can actually produce here in America. These are business people that have, you know, the solution to what's going on, and our politicians tend to think they can do it better.
Well, yeah, I mean, I agree in some regards to Mr. Trump, but I also have to tell you to remember that the public needs to remember a couple critical points about China. Number one, China's economic success is because of the United States. Okay, China's economic success is deliberately created by the United States financial institutions and the Western European financial institutions of Europe for one critical reason, and that is to create a greater and broader field from which to plunder. China did not possess, nor does it possess, the native capability to have an economically sustainable model. If you doubt that, watch what happens if the American public stops buying stuff. Watch what happens if Walmart stops providing 90% of their inventory through sourcing it through China. Watch what happens to China's economic engine if the U.S. stops selling its reclaimed steel. Watch what happens to China if you stop providing them that resource to crude oil in the global markets. You know, these are critical times, and remember that the process that drives the economy that you and I are suffering through right now is not only because of the lack of economic muscle. Remember this, only $3 trillion of the U.S. GDP represents productive wealth creation. The rest of it is government spending and consumption or what I refer to as transactional economics. That is the process of measured economic cycle and the best way to that creates income from the cycle. And an example of this is stock sales, right, or bond sales. They don't create anything. The money that's generated out of those transactions is just simply the money that's created from the transaction occurring. An example of this, commissions. Okay, remember that the process that's taking place in automobile industry here in the United States is simply occurring because it's the assembly process. It's not the manufacturing process. Okay, it is only the assembly process. So when you look at this concept of globalism, what folks really need to understand when you hear a congressman or senator say, "Well, we don't have any choice because we're now economically interconnected. We're in a global marketplace." Well, that's a bunch of pig fodder. Where was the global marketplace in the 1940s and the 1950s? If that was the case, why is it that Roosevelt created faulty and concealed his executive orders, shipping, allowing Kaiser Shipbuilding to build ships for the U.S. Navy? The Navy would mothball them, brand new ships, so that Roosevelt could conceal the program of giving the British naval surface ships under the guise that they were surplus naval vessels. By the way, they were never used, right? So all of this economic engine concept is based on productive industry, what I refer to as wealth creation industries. And so when you look at stuff that even Donald Trump, remember that the wealth that Mr. Trump enjoys, and there's a local businessman here who is a very honest man, and he said to me, he says, "You know, Curtis," he says, "I want you to remember that the wealth I have is only the result of uncontrolled inflation." Okay, this is a man who owns a lot of real estate. Okay, this is what I refer to as the faux economy. This is why the U.S. is suffering the way it is. This is one of the reasons why the U.S. is suffering the way it is, and that is because we have substituted the fundamental native requirement of wealth creation, and we've substituted it with the idea that you can create wealth equal to your ability to create debt. And that's the reality of it. If you want to see the resolve of – you want to see the real strength of China, stop – you take some of those ideas that I mentioned about incentivizing the tax code to require domestic enterprise investment, and watch how quickly Walmart stops purchasing from China. Watch how quickly the steel industry stops exporting raw or reclaimed steel, and watch what happens to China's industry. That's – think about how curious this is, and your audience will appreciate this if anybody's a student of history. Juxtapose what's taking place today in the United States economically and the global marketplace, and superimpose over it 1929 through 1941 and the bombing
Pearl Harbor.
And remember what was happening at the time in the economy with Japan. Japan was being compressed by the inability of Japan to get its raw materials from foreign sources. And it drove Japan south through the Solomons and was on its way to going towards Australia. It was moving into China, all of which to do what? Raw materials, right?
Well, and you know, I think you're spot on there, but the only people listening to you and people who recognize this is China. Because if you look what they're doing, they're buying up the resources in America and Australia because they know that they can't maintain themselves on their own country.
Absolutely right.
So while we're paying the price for our stupid behavior, China's recognizing these facts that you're saying, and they're starting to cushion against it.
Yeah.
So we need to act quicker than later is my only comment.
No, and I'm 100% with you on it. There was and this is the problem when you one of the problems we recognize with the way government functions in this impulse response, and that is congressmen and senators do not have their eye on the ball. Okay, they're fanning at pitches in the dirt. They're giving the public a false sense of success and function when, in fact, they are completely ignorant of the greater issues that are at risk for this country. Either by deliberate intention or pure ignorance, I don't really care. The fact of the matter is they're not doing it. And I believe the public is going to have to we're just going to have to stand up and start saying, wait a second, not on my watch. Okay.
Yeah, and we'll get to that. We're going to take this break. Now, your website is theperfectmessenger.com. It's really simple.
Theimperfectmessenger.com.
Oh, the imperfect. Okay, my producer typed it in a little wrong there. So
that's okay. Theimperfectmessenger.com. You know, you can from there your audience can get not only to Amazon and download the PDFs. You can also get to Facebook and become a fan. You can read the blogs. I mean, there's all sorts of real juicy stuff on there for a person who has the interest in equipping themselves with information that is really it's a little unusual. My approach is when you read the blogs and the commentaries, I kind of take a very different approach to commentary.
Okay, we're going to be taking a break here. If you have a question for Curtis now, it's the perfect time to call in, 801-254-5855. We'll get to those calls right after this break. This is Tim, Buyback America Radio, anyway. I'm here with Curtis Greco. Curtis, a lot of people, there are solutions to what's going on, but it seems like the more vocal Americans get, the more our politicians just tend to shut us out and ignore us. You know, the majority of people didn't want the Obamacare. We got it anyway. The majority of the people want our borders sealed up and immigration taken care of after we secure and protect our borders. They're ignoring that fact. So what is it that we can do to make them pay attention and just stop ignoring us?
Well, you know, this is the great challenge that lies in front of us. You know, when Congress or when government controls the conversation, it also controls access to it, right? We see this recently in a bill that's being worked out with, or I shouldn't say bill, it's being done off book between the Obama administration and the FCC. It's on the boards right now. They're planning on doing it before Christmas, and it is to permit the FCC to self-impose its entity upon the regulation of the internet. This can have severe First Amendment issues. It also could affect your ability to get information. In responding to your question directly, remember, as I've mentioned, and I say this all the time, and it's necessary to keep repeating it, and that is this: to remember that the government's not going to repair itself. Number one. Number two, the only immediate response that the public has, and that is through the ballot box. Number three, it's also important for the public to remember that Democrat and Republican concepts of government are not an integral part of the Constitution of the United States or the Declaration of Independence. In fact, if you go back to James Madison's commentaries in the Federalist Papers themselves, he warns the American people against partisan politics. He warns us against the great risk of the divide that is a native component of partisanship. Representative government has no partisanship component. The moment you accommodate partisanship is the moment the minority controls the outcome. The minority controls the majority's will. And that's what you see happening in Congress right now. The majority of the nation did not want Obamacare, but the minority, those that say they want Obamacare, and the Congress actually conforms to the minority opinion. So this is where the 10th Amendment becomes important. This is where I believe we can do our best work in controlling the federal government. This is how the public, guys like you and I, are ladies who are out there who are running business, you know, mom and pop businesses, can really start really tweaking the federal government, and it occurs this way. We need to get back to the ballot box initiative and force our states to eliminate party control of the ballot box. That's number one. Number two, we need to force through the ballot box governors to deliberately, specifically, and with surgical response go after government programs that completely and unilaterally violate the 10th Amendment. The 10th Amendment is a very simple concept. It simply says this: those provisions not enumerated herein are left to the states or to the people themselves. I paraphrased it. Okay? So if it's not enumerated in the Constitution, that is a specific role of government that is endorsed by the Constitution, those rules, those provisions are left to the states or to the people themselves. The unique design of the federal government was a form of government where states allowed themselves to become a part of a confederation that specifically and deliberately gave only certain responsibilities to the federal government. And the states ultimately preserve and reserve the right to control the federal government. Because remember also this to you and to all of us that we need to remember, is that if you allow the government to be a servant unto itself, not unlike the Supreme Court and any judiciary around the country, that is permitted to articulate its own ambition, then who checks the courts? Who checks the federal government, if not the states or the people themselves? That's the role of the Tenth Amendment. So my admonition to the public is this. Yes, we can have some effect on the federal level through Tea Party-esque type concepts, but the real blunt force trauma that will come to ultimately control the federal government will come from the states themselves. And you can see the beginning of this with this Obamacare stuff that's hitting the courts from the recent decision from the court in Virginia and the bravery of the Virginia AG. But the other question I have is this, is where are the other, you know, well, there's presently 25 states, I believe, involved in it or about to be involved in it, but where are the rest of the states? Okay, and so that's the big benefit. That's the big end game. This is, I promise you. By the way, there is a form of an action that's out there that goes back to the times of the Kentucky Compromise and the Missouri Compromise, and this became known as the concept of nullification, where states possess the unique right, implicit in the confederation that became the states adjoining to the constitutional form of government, the federal government. States uniquely possess the right to nullify any law, any federal law, that they believe to be contrary to the inalienable right of the sovereign state. It's important that folks in Utah and every other 49 states, any other 49 states, remember that as individual states, you are a sovereign state, and your adjoining to the federal government is not by command of the federal government, but by the election of the state. And because of that, it is the supreme design of the Constitution, and it's pure genius. It's absolutely pure genius. The Tenth Amendment is pure genius. It gives the states the ultimate check and balancing force to control the federal government. But isn't it interesting?
If the states will step up and do it.
Absolutely. But that was going to be my next comment. And I said, but isn't it interesting how silent the states have been? Right?
Yeah. Right. That's because they're part of that two-party system, if you look at it.
That's right. And so what we're going to do, what the public's going to do, and what we're going to force enforce on the federal government is we're going to work deliberately towards the destabilization and ultimately the removal of this partisanship politics concept that has basically given us a parliamentarian form of government.
Curtis, I know I had you for 2 hours. Can you hang out through this top of the hour break for just a little bit longer?
We'll hang out for a bit. Go ahead.
Okay, all right. We're going to be taking this top of the hour break. We'll be back. Curtis is going to hang out with us just a little bit longer. So if you have questions for Curtis, you can get in on this break, and then we'll take you before we start rambling on again. So give us a call, 801-254-5855. We'll be back. Curtis, you have 6-7 minutes. Stretch your legs. You know, welcome, patriots. I got to say, I love that intro. Reagan had so many positive things to say that are just uplifting. You got to love uplifting speeches. My guest is Curtis Greco. He is the author of the Blind Vision book series and the founder of the Imperfect Messenger Foundation. He is out there. He's a passionate patriot. He's out there trying to let people know there is hope. We do have hope, and nullification would be a great thing. There are governors stepping up out there, Curtis. We just need more.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting listening to your intro, as you say. That's a great series, a compilation of Reagan comments. There's one that I have in the book that is a product of my own efforts, and hopefully before we depart today, I'll get the opportunity to read it for you and your listeners. But you're right. The states need to step up, and this is, again, just to close out that comment. Yeah, the people say, well, I don't know what we can do, and I have a comment that I say, you know, even at some point, you know, ambivalence can become ambivalent, right? But, you know, there is something we can do. And it's just like we said, you know, we'll target at the local levels, at our respective state levels, and we'll take it back. And I just have, you know, supreme confidence. I have to remember, it was a very small group of people in the 1700s. Majority of the nation at that time of the colonies just wanted things to just, no, I don't want to fight.
The status quo. They were fine.
We're fine, you know, let's just leave it alone. You know, they're there a couple thousand miles away. What can they do, right? But it was interesting, a very small group of people, a very small group of willing, of the willing, who converged upon a common ideal, and the rest is history. And the thing that we also always need to remind ourselves, you know, we can't go back. You know, this country cannot fold its tent and go back. To do so, for us to look at one another and to our progeny, to those that will come and history will record, and to say to them that everything that the men and women whose images remain on the soils of foreign lands, it didn't matter. To say to them, it didn't matter. It was a waste of time. Everything that we fought and died for, everything that our forefathers stood up for and accounted themselves before their providential notions of the Creator, and to tell them and to say to them in good conscience, you don't matter. I can't do that.
I don't think I could either, and I don't think many of my listeners would, but there are still those in America who don't realize. And I noticed this while I was sitting at church this weekend. I looked around the congregation, and how many of them are just, I don't know if the word's complacent or just so caught up in their own lives, that they're really not aware of what's happening around them. And I can't remember which founding father it was right off the top of my head, but, you know, liberties once lost, they're almost impossible to get back.
Right. You know, the Benjamin Franklin said it, you know, those who surrender freedom for security deserve neither, right? There's, I paraphrase that it's kind of a version of that, but anyways, but you're right, and that's what this work is all about. I'm not, you know, I got better things to do. You know, I could be, you know, just like in my church, you know, sitting there on Sunday and going through service, and I was kind of strange, serendipitous as the case may be, that, you know, I'm thinking the same thing, and I noticed something that I don't know if you noticed. I actually think that there is a quiet desperation, that what we are seeing in the country, and I'm working on a new article, and it's called Distression. It's a compilation of two words, distress and depression. Distression. And what I'm seeing is this desperation around us. One, what's happening to our country? Two, what is it? Why is it happening? Three, why has the government done this? Number four, why isn't the government doing something? And what will I do next, right? And I see this, I sense this pulse, this sort of tension in the air as I travel around the country. I see it in airports as people are lining up like cattle to go through the groping session. And I observe it in the tension that I see in their eyes. It's this sort of internal belief that they can't believe they're having to endure this, but that they are powerless to do anything about it. You know, that's a horrible sentiment. That's a horrible way for an American to have to endure life in the once sacred, in a nation that once held the providential inalienable rights of the individual sacred.
You know, that's a great way to summarize that. That, and I say it all the time, there's a fine line between depression and happiness anymore. People are walking this very fine line. And our politicians are doing almost everything they can to push us over into the depression side.
Yeah, and it's, and again, yeah, I get that, but I there's something in the equation. There's something not right in the mix. What is it about a politician that will look at you in the camera and openly and defiantly tell you something that you know intuitively, intellectually, spiritually, that is not right? It's not just hubris. It's not just ignorance. There's something deeper in there. And I believe that what it really boils down to is the lack of ownership and the lack of trust, that the public is now moved beyond this point where government can fix things to a fundamental understanding that government is not trustworthy.
And I agree with you. And the problem with that way of thinking, which it's true, is that you give up totally on government and you don't pay attention, you don't vote, the only thing that's going to happen is it's going to get worse.
That's like I said earlier. I said, doesn't ultimately ambivalence give way to ambivalent, right? Ultimately, people who are say this concept of, well, you know, there's nothing I can do, so I might as well not care, right? Ambivalence and the ambivalent, right? And but I can't, you know, when I'm speaking in front of groups, about 2 weeks ago I was in front of a large group in Southern California, and then I flew over to the Phoenix area, and I did a piece there. And one of the things I reminded folks in the audience was about this premise that I use in the Founding Ideals in Exile, and that is this. You know, I have a fundamental faith and belief system that I express, and that is something is very simple. It says this. I believe in the inalienable rights and the connection between the providential, okay? I believe that whatever, you know, I don't know who God is, okay? I can't point to it and say that's God. I'm not able to take the image of Michelangelo's painting on the Sistine Chapel and look at the image and say that's what God looks like. I don't know what God looks like. I just know that he is. Okay, regardless of your faith-based organization or enterprises or whatever, you know, I happen to be raised Roman Catholic, but I don't look. I choose the Roman Catholic faith. The Roman Catholic faith didn't choose me. The ideals that lie back of what I hold to be faithfulness is not owned by the Catholic Church. I always remember that Jesus was not a Catholic. He was not a Mormon. He was not a Lutheran. He was not a Methodist. He was not a Anglican. He was a Jew, okay, who took and leaped to a whole new paradigm that became the Christian faith, for lack of a better reference, that exposed for the first time an entirely different approach to human understanding of what became a faith-based entity. Man does this nasty thing, and we do it constantly to one another. When we attempt to define the indefinable into constructs that humans can understand, and in the process of believing that we now understand, we now take the next leap off the cliff to believe that our impressions are accurate and that we can redefine the corporal form that only the divine has the providence to do. And all I know is that I believe that there's a divinity out there. I believe that there's this thing called God. I know it to be so because I look at it every day when I see my children. I see it when I go out into the world around me and I see other humans engaged in the toil of attempting to perfect the corporal form that God expressed. And I believe that's worth our understanding and why the piece Founding Ideals in Exiles will be captivating to so many people when they listen to it.
I agree with you, Curtis. We're going to take this quick break, then we have a caller for you after this break. We'll be right back with more Curtis Greco on Buy Back America Radio.
The voice of Utah, AM 630 K-Talk.
K-Talk.com.
Number one for the most live, local, two-way talk.
Say it isn't so. The time goes by so fast. Curtis, we got a caller. Let's go ahead and get him on. Nick, welcome to the show.
Curtis.
Hi, Nick.
Pleasure listening to you speak. Quite brilliant and quite, you know, aimed at the point, the heart of the problem. What I was going to ask is about this FCC meeting coming up. I think it's tomorrow. I heard briefly about it. And I guess their lead attack dog is going to be Reverend so-called Reverend Al Sharpton, the black racist who basically tried to send three white police officers to prison for life for rape they didn't commit. But we'll get beyond that. He's accusing Rush Limbaugh of using the word magic Negro in reference to Obama, which is straight out of the Los Angeles Times, by the way.
Right.
Nonetheless, the attack is aimed at taking control of the Internet. That's what they really want control of, and they want talk radio off the air. And I think this is the most dangerous assault to our freedom and the Constitution to be jammed through in a lame duck Congress filled with basically little bootlickers for Pelosi and Harry, or not Pelosi, Harry Reid's in the Senate. But it's frightening that these people have lost their seats, but they still serve their new world order master, and that's what this is. We ask why these people don't respond to us. Why would they respond to us when they're being promised positions of power in a new world order? Why want to serve the United States anymore? An example would be Bill Richardson run out of office basically in New Mexico when it was found out how corrupt he was. He had to drop out of the presidential race. Now where is he? He's being recycled as a potential new Secretary of State, evidently, over in North Korea, and being glorified as bringing about some kind of peace resolution. This is all so phony. Anybody that can connect two brain cells can see through it. But unfortunately, America is to the point that we're almost too dumb anymore to be free, and that's my comment. I do agree with you. A small contingent can do something, but they have to be willing to die for it.
Thank you, Nick. You want to respond to that, Curtis?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Nick's point's well taken. You know, though, just a real bulk, quick couple of bullets to his question, to his comment. Number one, the FCC issue and the control of the internet is a conspicuous example of the divisive impulse of the rush to do a legislation action, legislative functions or governance in the absence of an intellectually sound discourse. In other words, clearly, it's a violation of a fundamental component of the Constitution, vis-a-vis the First Amendment. Number two, you're absolutely right. When they can control the dissemination of information, they also ultimately control what you become to believe to be so. And so when you control the internet and ultimately talk radio, you completely sever the link between honest flow of information and the freedom that is inalienable to an individual to attach themselves to the information of their choice. The New World Order thing, you know, I hear this and a lot about this sort of globalist New World Order thing, and I believe that it is a trend that is the natural evolution of people, or the natural result of people not engaging in their government, that leaves government to engage in whatever enterprise it wants to. So I believe that you're right, Nick, if you're still listening, that there is this trend into this so-called New World Order thing. But I don't think that it's – I do not believe that it is a mandate. I do not believe that it is inevitable. I do not believe that there is an opposing force willing to engage to keep it from happening. I am a diehard in the sense of the belief in providential ideals. Not only are there more Americans than there are those that would oppose those Americans, but I have a power far greater than any of them can compose, and that is the fundamental belief that God has ordained that people should be free. It is your inalienable right. It is your inalienable right to express the physical manifestation of God's intention, which is what each and every human being is. God intended that his divine mind be expressed magnificently and brilliantly, and he created his children to do that. And nobody messes with that. And
okay,
you're right.
Curtis, we got another caller here. Let's go ahead and go to Daryl. And if you want to get on the phone, it's 801-254-5855. Daryl, you got a comment for Curtis?
Yes, you made a comment about how the government doesn't produce any money. They just gather it from the producers, the taxpayers, and spend it. That's kind of what I'd like to just play this sound by. This is by Lady Thatcher in July 1979, and get your comment about it.
Cause that's a great quote.
The state has no source of money other than the money people earn themselves. If the state wishes to spend more, it can do so only by borrowing your savings or by taxing you more. And it's no good thinking that someone else will pay. That someone else is you. There is no such thing as public money. There is only taxpayers' money.
What do you think about that?
Well,
it's
absolutely correct. And remember, there's another component of that speech that the great Margaret Thatcher said. And she said, the problem with socialism is sooner or later, government runs out of other people's money to spend. Okay.
Yeah, they run out of people they can take it from.
That's absolutely right. And so you're absolutely right. And what an absolute, absolutely magnificent piece. You know, the UK I feel so bad for the British people that there is not another Margaret Thatcher out there, or at least presently. But she was a brilliant and courageous woman, and just an extraordinary, extraordinary gift. But, yes, to answer your question, there's two components in the equation. One is the threat of government and its seemingly unlimited powers to do precisely what it wants, which simply has been fabricated, but nonetheless they're getting away with it. And number two is the monetary policy of the Federal Reserve that accommodates that process occurring.
Okay, go ahead, Darryl.
Yeah, the money that government is acquiring through taxpayers is usually wasted in foreign aid and in other stupid adventures. You guys?
All right.
Sorry about that in the background.
It's okay. Darryl, we appreciate that, and thank you for your call.
Yeah, hey, I got to get I'm still going to get that book to you. Plus, I got another one I'm going to be sending you to for some more sound bites like this.
All right, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
You know, there are people, and that's the good thing, is like Nick was saying, there are people willing to fight. I'm pretty sure of that there are people out there not going to give up on our country.
Yeah,
our politicians, they're going to give up on, but I don't think they're going to give up on the country.
No, there's too many of us who feel this way. And one of the things I have to add into this and caution the public, and when I talk about, and you and I think you probably feel the same way, when I talk about fight and stand up and be accountable and stand for a cause worth perfecting, I don't mean violence. I don't buy that's the inevitability of conflict. Primarily also because it's not a good strategy, particularly in a case like a government of the United States that completely is overwhelmingly equipped to have a physical confrontation and come out quite successfully. No, I'm talking about a completely different approach, and I believe it can be done through the ballot box. I believe that we can take it back. I know we can. No one's going to survive an intellectual conversation with yours truly on the question of whether or not the United States cannot ultimately restore itself to its inalienable and defined processes of protecting, perfecting, and preserving the inalienable rights of the individual. And I can't give credibility to any other opposing argument because it doesn't sustain. They are unsustainable, much like the federal government.
What we got to do is take it back one at a time. We need to make sure that the people we put in the office are ethical and not this two-party system. We got to get away from that.
We've got to get away from it. There's a great little anecdote in the book I'll share it real quick now that gives a great example if it's okay with you, and that is the starfish metaphor that I use. There's a man walking along the beach, and intermittently he bends down and appears to be throwing something back into the water, and he's observed by a couple who's walking towards him. And as their points converge and they get closer and closer, what she realizes, the husband and wife who was observing this man, realize they find themselves in this massive field of starfish that was washed up from a storm the night before. And they see this man bending down, picking up a starfish and tossing him back into the ocean. Well, the woman says to the man, she goes, "What are you doing?" She goes, "Well, I'm throwing starfish back into the ocean." She goes, "But there's hundreds of thousands of them. What possible difference can you make?" As he bends down and picks up another starfish and tosses it back into the sea, and he says, "I made a difference to that one." And so I believe one starfish at a time, one issue at a time, hand in hand, together as a nation of people converging upon the very common ideals that define us, we can preserve the Declaration of Independence. We can preserve and restore the fundamental and inalienable rights implicit in the Constitution of the United States. And by doing so, pass on the legacy of self-governance as it was intended by the founding fathers of this country and inspired by the very providential ideal that instilled the ambition in the mind of man.
I agree with you. We got a couple more callers. We're going to be taking a break here in just 1 second, Curtis. We'll be back. I'll let you address these callers, and we'll get your website one more time and say goodbye and thank you. But hold on just tight. We'll get to these callers right after this break. This is Tim, Buyback America Radio. My guest is Curtis Greco. We'll be back after this break. Start me up. Curtis, let's take these last few callers before we have to go. Hey, welcome to the show. You got a question for Curtis?
Yeah, this is Jay. I am just wondering, how important is it that we recognize our foes in the battlefield that we are on? It's more of a rhetorical question, but I wish you'd just pose an answer to that.
All right, well, thank you for the call, and we'll answer that. Curtis, I think it's important that you recognize your foes, or else we can't replace them.
Oh, you know, ultimately, you have to know who your enemy is, right? You have to know what your opposition is. You know, but there's an interesting piece, you know, that I'm a great student of history. I enjoy it because I think you learn an awful lot from it. There's a third century Chinese warrior that gets a lot of war play every once in a while. Sun Tzu, actually 6th century. And he says, you know, there's a...
The art of war.
In the art of war... He has a great quote that I love. I'm compelled by it. It says, "So in war, the way is to avoid what is strong and to strike at what is weak." Okay, and that's a critical component of a response to the caller's inquiry about recognizing the foe. Remember that the force that is out there that we seem to believe is in opposition to our national will is actually not an imposing force at all, okay? It's not an overwhelming force at all.
I mean, come on, Barney Frank scares you.
Oh, Barney Franks, you know, yeah. Barney Franks is an intimidating character. You know, this character from New York, Mr. Weiner. I mean, you know, this is a guy who is amused at this man's ability to actually defeat his own argument the moment he opens his mouth.
I know.
The guy's frightening. But it is important to understand, for the public to understand, for your caller to understand, these are foes to be sure, but they are few, and they are given the illusion of power because there is no one objecting to what they do.
There's your answer, caller. Let's go ahead and move on to the next one. I think that's plain and simple there.
You betcha.
I don't get a chance for the follow-up.
Oh, go ahead.
My follow-up is that sometimes our foes are harder to recognize because I was amazed today. It's been quite a while since I've watched local TV but today I was looking at it at the weather, and I was amazed that what passes for conservative in Salt Lake, Doug Wright, said that it was unfortunate that Hatch was able to stop the DREAM Act.
Well, I don't think that Doug Wright, anybody who listens to me or this show, really pictures him as a conservative.
Well, and the follow up to that is, I am certainly grateful that you guys are out there and that your audience is growing, because I was not one of them.
Well,
but
you
I
can
been since I got involved again in politics this last time. I'm a delegate chair. And what he said was unfortunate, that those right-wing Tea Party people had so much power in the state of Utah. He doesn't realize, if he'd get out of Salt Lake, most of Utah is right-wing Tea Party people.
Yeah.
So that's my comment for the day.
I appreciate that, and that's why, you know, I don't even put him on the same level as my show.
Well, if I might add real quick to your callers, you want to excel at something, my friend, then here's what I got a challenge for you. If you've got the conviction that you state, here's what I want you to do, is go out and reach 10, okay? Go out, instead of being your greatest fan, and I don't mean this as an admonition, I actually mean this to inspire you. If what we believe is true, then we need an army of people willing to converge again upon a common ideal. So my strategy is, each one reach 10, okay? Everybody, reach another 10 people. Invite them into the conversation. Invite them to listen to this show. Invite them to engage.
I am working at it.
No. This isn't. I'm not. Again, as I mentioned, it's not a personal admonition. It's a broadcast to all the listeners. Make a difference.
I agree.
Make a
Thank
difference.
You.
Thank you,
sir.
Let's go ahead and go to Rob. Rob, welcome to the show.
I hope this weather doesn't have you guys scared, does it?
it don't scare me. I'm still waiting for my caller to get back with me and let me know what Saturday we can do my one voice march on our own capital, and I'll be there.
I'm also waiting for.
I mean, your guest there because, yeah, it's going to take the tar and feather, flaming torches and the pitchfork and the guillotine and the stockade would be fun. I think it's going to have to be done by voting.
Yep.
And I think these politicians across this nation now are finally getting, you know, the drift of what we're trying to get accomplished here. I mean, I did you guys watch the 60 Minutes with Governor Christie?
I did.
What'd you think of it?
You know, I like a lot of what Governor Christie stands for. I like a lot of what some of these governors are standing for, but I think they can go further.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I that's where I kind of grew up there in that new state of New Jersey, and it's a mess there.
You know, the these politicians that make these appearances and they morph to conform to 3-minute or 3-second sound bites have got to stop planning for future elections. They have got to be willing to stand on the principle and die politically by their principle instead of strategizing their responses to integrate their presence or their name recognition into a future ballot. You know, I call it what we need to do is I believe we need to shame them into submission through the ballot box. And that's the great flaw that we are having with people like Sarah Palin and all these sort of sensationalizing leadership. There's nothing sensational about leadership. There is nothing sensational about focused discipline and nobility. It is, by the very nature of its form, its own provocation. You don't need this sort of sound bites. You don't need this sort of elaborate dissertations. People know it. You know it when you're being lied to. You know it when you're being told an untruth. You know it when you see a thief. There's a great quote from a Sufi poet from the 300 BC, and he says this: when a pickpocket observes a saint, all he observes are pockets. Okay? And what's the significance of it? If you allow a politician to play the game of political speak and partisanships, when he sees you, he doesn't see you.
Yeah, we're not allowing him to do that. I mean, that's obvious. That's on the table now. I mean,
he sees a vote.
Nobody does, you know, like I always say, you know, if I was the president, one of the first things I'd do is raise the tariff. And then if I heard anybody say Republican or Democrat, you'd be packing up your office and going home.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's so many problems on the table right now in this country. That's not even an option. We're running out of money. It's not sustainable what they're getting. And I've been saying that for a long time. And
all right, Rob.
You're going to see a lot of cities go down, guys. Well,
all right, Rob, I got to move on. I got another caller online.
Get that date set.
I know, I will. Thanks.
Stop dragging your food.
Okay. All right, Curtis, let's take one more caller real quick. Dave, you have a comment for Curtis?
Yes, how are you guys?
I'm well.
Good show today. One thing your guest said today that I do believe you can change things at the ballot box. But you're right, Tim. You need to get out of that left-right paradigm thinking. Has to get the public has to get out of there. You know, I was a state delegate here in Utah many times, and I was lucky to persuade about 20 to 30 delegates to vote for actually somebody who supports the Constitution. And that's the hardest thing we could find now is they can, I mean, these, especially in the two parties, they can talk Constitution all they want, but obviously when they get back to Washington, that's a different story.
Yeah, it's what they say on TV, and it's like what Curtis said, that 60-minute soundbite, 60-second soundbite, 3-minute soundbite, we got to stop buying into those. We need to start looking at the person and what he actually stands for once he reaches that floor of the House or the Senate.
Yes, the one thing I've seen here in our community, Tim, is that I see a lot of people talking that they do want to make the change, and they say they're going to do that voting a different way, but they still turn back and they I don't know if it's out of fear, complacency, or whatever the case is, and it's just ridiculous. You have to get out of that comfort zone if you do want to preserve your freedom.
I agree. Hey, Dave, I appreciate that. We're coming to a break now. Curtis, hang through this break one last time. We'll get you to say your final remarks and your website one more time, and then we'll let you go.
Okay, sir.
So we'll be back after this break. This is Tim, your host of Buy Back America Radio. I'm here with Curtis Greco. Who can it be now? It's me, Tim, Buy Back America Radio. Hey, Curtis, I appreciate you coming on the show today. Is there any closing message you'd like to give my listeners?
Well, yes, but let me tell you this. I'm
It'd
grateful.
Help if I turned you on.
Yeah. I just want to tell you that I'm grateful for the opportunity to be with you. I look forward to doing it again. This is a conversation that needs to be had more and more nationally. And I'm grateful for you and the Buy Back America movement to begin the process of reclaiming our providential ideals, our providential and inalienable rights. So I'm grateful to that, you know, for the kind words that you express in my direction, but I must flip it back to you guys and commend you for being willing to take up the challenge. It is a cause worth perfecting. So again, thank you for the opportunity. If it's okay with you, I'd like to close my contribution to your segment with a little excerpt from book one, We Hold These Truths, and it goes like this. An American is not only the individual who may find on these shores a companion in providential ideals. However, it is truly and only these providential ideals that define an American. It is a pulse that resonates with the rhythm of truth in all people of all nations whose hearts beat with the cadence of but one word, freedom. It is then not only for this union to champion so noble a cause, but for all to assert and ascend to the ideal of freedom, liberty, and justice. By doing so, we banish tyranny in all its forms to the regime of failure. So I welcome you all to engage in the dialogues that I promote through the Imperfect Messenger Foundation. The website is www.theimperfectmessenger.com. To obviously, you know, I'd love to see you buy books and encourage your friends to buy books. They're valuable. They are worthy of being in your permanent library. They are timeless. There's a lot of incredible material in them, and you'll enjoy them. Become a friend of the Imperfect Messenger on Facebook. Follow the tweets. Follow the dialogues, the commentaries. They're short, but they're always hot. They're always provocative, and they're always engaging. And they are always focused at provoking in you a desire to preserve and protect your inalienable rights and to assert providential ideals over any being that would impose their will upon you. And so I thank you again, and I'm excited. I'm thrilled at the privilege to be at this place and in this time in American history. It's exciting. It's exhilarating. Yes, it's testy. Yes, it's going to be a tough, a very difficult time for a public that is accustomed to having things appear effortless and having to not be accountable to a cause worth perfecting. But in the end, it's important that we all remember this. A man must be free for independence to be at liberty to be expressed. And express it we must, because after all, you too, each and every one, is a messenger. And that's what the Foundation talks about. So, that's my call.
I appreciate it, Curtis. Thank you.
Okay,
I will be in touch.
Let's do it again. And again, to everybody who's listening, Merry Christmas and all the best for the new year. And let's make it count.
All right. You have a good day, Curtis. Thank you.
You too, my friend. Thanks so much.